committee to order today. We have a few people signed up for Senate Bill 978, so we will begin by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 978, and I believe Representative Richardson is here to testify on that. And you can have up whoever you want, Representative Richardson.
We can join together here.
Now we need our
Welcome, both of you.
Madam Chair, representatives of the committee, senators, we are here to discuss Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 978. I have a very limited involvement in this, in that a district attorney from Jackson County, Mark Huddleston, asked if we would add to the amendments that Mary can speak on, which were a consensus amendment. And basically what we wanted to do was merely add to the personal identifiers information relating to bank or credit card account information. And this bill relates to trying to protect witnesses from having their personal information disclosed to defendants in criminal proceedings, because there's been instances where those criminals have then used that information in a very detrimental way to these witnesses. And so all I'm here to do is just to ask for the committee's willingness to allow this additional wording in personal identifiers to include bank and credit card information.
Thank you. Other questions of Representative Richardson? Thank you very much. Ms. Botkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, and I do have written testimony. So let me just say very briefly, I'm operating on the premise that less is more at this point. We identified a problem through some of our Department of Corrections staff that inmates were actually accessing personal identifiers of their victims through getting copies of their criminal files. And what was happening was that in the criminal file, the witnesses and people associated with the case are identified in the criminal file by name, date of birth, and social security number. And that even though there were statutes on the books requiring redaction of those papers, not always were those papers completely redacted. And in fact, police reports were often coming to the inmates with all of the personal identifiers intact. Additionally, we found that the Department of Corrections was requiring visitors to sign in using date of birth and social security numbers as part of their sign-in requirements. And inmates were, surprise, surprise, getting a hold of sign-up sheets and selling that information to their friends who were not in prison with them, but rather out on the streets. What this bill does is stop that practice. That's all it does. It's not going to stop bad guys from being bad guys. It's not going to stop criminals from being criminals. And I'm sure that they will come up with a new way to do this, or a new way to do something in time. All we can do is plug a hole that we know exists, and that's all this bill does. It doesn't make anything like it did to begin with. All of the Class A felony issues have been removed from the bill. Madam Chair, if it would be helpful, I can walk through the changes if you want me to, but I think suffice it to say that this is a greatly reduced bill from the beginning. We met in a work group with Representative Richardson's staff, with Mark Huddleston from Jackson County, with Dan Norris from Malheur County, both district attorneys, and we had the defense bar and the criminal bar both in the meeting so that we were sure that people got what they have to do their jobs, but we were able to keep the information from the folks who don't need it, who want to do illicit things with it. So anyway, this bill is a pretty important bill for us, only because a number of our staff and our volunteers have been victimized by inmates in the institution. So again, less is more. I think this is a good bill. I think it's a better bill now that we've had a work group and worked through it. And committee counsel was most helpful in assisting us in getting sort of where we needed to be.
Thank you very much.
And speaking of committee counsel in the Better Late Than Never department, I forgot to have him summarize the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments. So if you wouldn't mind standing by while he does that, and then we can move into questions on the amendment. I apologize to the audience if any of you are perplexed about what this bill does. But we're about to find out, counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Basically now under current law, as a matter of due process, district attorney has to give certain information to a defense counsel. And defense counsel, where their personal names and addresses is not supposed to give that information to the defendant. If the defendant is not represented by counsel, that same provision applies. And what this bill does is basically expand the information that cannot be given to either the defense or the defense counsel can't give to his client, or if not represented by counsel, the district attorney does not have to give to the unrepresented counsel, defendant. Personal identifiers means a person's address, telephone number, social security number, and date of birth, and the identifying number of the person's depository account at a financial institution, and it defines it, or a credit card account. The Dash 3 is more expansive than the Dash 2, and I'm quickly looking for the Dash 2, but I don't see them in front of me.
The Dash 3, as I understand it from reading it, replaces the Dash 2.
Dash 2 and Dash 1, that's correct, Madam Chair. Dash 2, it says personal identifiers means a person's address, telephone number, social security number, and date of birth. So the Dash 3 is particularly a bit more expansive as it relates to financial information. And I understand that from talking to Ms. Botkin that she would prefer the Dash 3 amendments.
Right. Madam Chair, one thing that was brought up to me just prior to the hearing was, and right now we really don't want to derail this bill at all. If making any other changes would derail it, we'll just proceed forward. But Dan Norris did suggest that it might be appropriate to insert the term home in front of addresses, because in a number of cases, the DAs release an officer's address, they release the institutional address where they work rather than their home addresses. And if that's clarifying, then that's fine. But if it requires you to go back to legislative council and get another hearing, mm-hmm. we'd rather have the bill moved.
Well, we like to send clean bills over, but I think with something like that, we can rely on our colleagues in the House to help us out with that one. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now we have Dan Norris, who has traveled from afar to be with us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dan Norris. I'm the District Attorney from Madison County, Oregon, here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association.
Welcome to the committee. I hope you had a nice drive today in this beautiful weather.
Wonderful drive, and my son's playing in the state baseball tournament, so I'm going to do two things.
Oh, a twofer. That's great.
The DAs do support this bill, even though it's going to put a little more of a burden on our office than we've had in the past in terms of redacting information. Having the largest prison in the state in my jurisdiction, I've seen firsthand how my discovery can lead to the victimization of officers and volunteers. We've gone one step further in my office. I redact all of the information even before I give it to the defense attorneys so that they don't have to do it when they provide their files to their clients. My local defense bar appreciates that because they don't want to spend the time to do that with their staff, and they don't need someone's social security number or date of birth or their home address. They know they can find those officers at Snake River. So I urge the committee to recommend a due pass out of the committee.
I appreciate that. And you were quoted as being the author of the suggestion to insert home before address. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. That's a constructive change.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pazansky.
And Dan, the other thing, just for the record, that would be in the personal identifiers on page 1, line 7, is where you're suggesting that should go.
Yes. And also on page 2, line 27, where personal identifiers is defined,
Personal identifiers means a person's home address, home telephone number, social security number, and date of birth.
Okay, I just want to get that on the record as well, is that not only home address, but home telephone number.
Yeah, we're trying with the home telephone number, because of the reverse directories, they have the ability to locate.
Right.
Members of the committee, Senator Brzezinski, I didn't catch that correctly, but you're talking about page 3, line 8, the definition of personal identifiers.
What you mean from the Dash 3 amendments?
Home address,
home
telephone number. So it'd be page 3, line 8. After persons and so
home. We've got two things going here. We've got the Dash 3 amendment. Is that what you have in front of you?
I do have the Dash 3 amendment. Maybe Ms. Botkins can help.
That's where we're looking. Page 3, line 8.
Right. Is that the one you're at there?
Yep. So what they're doing is your phone there and home there.
I believe so.
It looks like.
Council?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Okay. So home address, home telephone number. Okay. Thank you. All right. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, Madam Chair.
We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 978. And this is pretty straightforward, Senator Starr, so I think we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 978, and we have the Dash 3 amendments in front of us.
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 978.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 978. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered, Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 978 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 978 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who would like to carry this?
I'll do it.
Senator Brzezinski will carry this. Okay. Now... Mr. Cruz in the audience here. I think we're going to move into the star attraction of the day committee, the cheating bill, which is not really the cheating bill, it's the Blakely bill. We'll move into work session on Senate Bill 528. Council.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 528 has been before the committee now several times. It is the bill that attempts to bring Oregon statutes in compliance with the U.S. Supreme Court case in Blakely versus Washington, the state of Oregon Supreme Court case in State versus Diltz, by creating a process by which enhancement facts that would increase the presumptive sentence in a felony sentencing could be pled, and how those facts could be proven to a jury. The last work session we had on this was on the 12th, I believe, of May, and at that time we had a discussion about whether or not the provisions of the measure should apply retroactively to cases on remand that will result in a resentencing. They are referred to, if you will, as cases in the pipeline. And the Dash 10 amendment before you does include the language that would make the process applicable to those cases that are on remand that will result in a resentencing. The other change that the Dash 10 amendment makes from the prior amendment is a point that was raised by District Attorney Brad Berry at our last hearing with respect to jury agreement. There was an unintended consequence of the way the language was written that suggested that more than 10 jurors might need to agree to the enhancement if more than 10 jurors initially agreed to guilt. And that, of course, would be beyond the requirements of current law. So that section about jury agreement has been recrafted to ensure that, really it ensures two things. One is that the number of jurors required for the conviction must be the same number of jurors that are required to prove the enhancement. That's number one. The other, and not more. The other thing that it does is it ensures, under a case called State v. Boots, that there be compliance in that the same jurors, at least the same jurors, who are minimally required to agree to guilt, must be the same jurors that are minimally required to agree to the enhancement fact. So in other words, the way Mr. Berry put it was, you can't have a situation where 11 jurors are agreeing to guilt, and then you need 11 jurors who the same 11 jurors who agree to the enhancement. Rather, if you have 11 jurors agreeing to guilt, because that's what's required for a felony case, then at least 10 of those 11 who agreed to guilt must agree to the enhancement. That's the only way the enhancement can be proved beyond reasonable doubt. I hope I've adequately explained that.
Yeah, and committee, that we struggled with that in the work session. I think Ms. Vanderbilt downstairs in Legislative Council did a very good job. It appears on page 4, lines 6 through 15. I think it's clear that what we were trying to get at, we struggled a little bit with the language in the committee, but I think she did a good job.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could also add the fiscal impact statement has not yet been received on this measure, but I have spoken to John Borden at LFO several times today, as recently as just before I came down the hall. He had hoped that the fiscal impact statement would be ready to provide to the committee. It is not. He has a draft written, and he has been instructed to redo the draft to make it a little more concise. But the bottom line is that the fiscal impact is going to be indeterminate. They're not anticipated to be any increased cost to DOC, but there are anticipated to be increased costs to both Public Defense Services Commission, prosecutors, and the Oregon Judicial Department. But LFO, based on the input they've received from those agencies, is not able to be in a position where they can determine what that cost will be.
Okay, so it's your understanding that because the fiscal impact is indeterminate, it would not trigger the local impact provision that we were talking about the other day?
Madam Chair, that's my understanding, yes.
Okay, and you have seen the draft. Okay. All right. We had a good discussion our last work session on whether Blakely should be retroactive insofar as cases that are in the pipeline versus making it apply only to convictions after the effective date. And I personally was convinced that the retroactivity argument made its case better because if there is going to be an ex post facto issue, this does nothing to stop that from moving forward, and the courts in practice would most likely develop their own systems, which also would be subject to challenge and would not have any kind of statutory basis. So this would be retroactive to cases in the pipeline, but would not be retroactive to cases that already have been adjudicated. So do committee members have any have already gotten through the process? In other words, if someone has exhausted all their appeals, the Blakely is being interpreted not to apply to those cases right now, unless we hear otherwise. So if somebody has already exhausted all their appeals, they're serving their sentence, Blakely is not being interpreted to apply. Is that correct, counsel?
Madam Chair, yes, that's my understanding. Specifically, my understanding is the way that the Dash 10 is written, that the retroactivity provision applies to cases for which there is not a final judgment that are remanded and for which will result in a resentencing on that remand. And I think we heard testimony at the last hearing that it's estimated that that might be about 200 or so cases.
Question, so the Dash 10s represent the Dash 9s, not the Dash 8s with the fix?
That is my recollection, Senator Breyer. Let me check very, very quickly. I have it in here.
The Dash 9s are the ones that the DAs and the judges like, and Dash 8s are the ones that the criminal defense lawyers like.
That's correct.
So I just want to make sure these represent the dash nines.
They represent the position that was advanced by the DAs and the judges. And the dash eights represented...
Yeah, okay.
Mary, place. I'm Chair of the...
Senator Starr.
My understanding is then that the dash 10 replaces the bill and covers all the issues that we've discussed.
That's correct. It's a complete stuff of the bill.
Madam Chair, Senator Byer and yourself are both correct. Of these prior versions that we've had several of, the dash 8 was the version that did not apply retroactively, and I believe we had testimony in support of that from the Criminal Defense Bar and Public Defense Services, and the dash 9 was the version that applied retroactively. There is a dash 10 because we had to change that provision
yes.
with respect to jury agreement, but the dash 10 has that change and has the retroactivity as to cases on remand in it.
Okay. It's been a long... Senator Pazanski.
Madam Chair, I just want to go back with a stat. You were saying as to the number of people in the verdict and all that. I may have misunderstood you, but I thought the example you gave us said that it took 11-1 for the guilty verdict. And, you know, there's a 10-2, except where you have on the ag murder 11-1, or if it's capital punishment, will be unanimous. So with that known as what the parameters are, if you're going for an enhancement, does it only take 10 of the 12, or does it take the equal number, at least the equal number, of those who actually voted for guilt?
Chair Burdick, Senator Przanski, the example I was using was an example where 10 were required to convict, and if 11 agreed to guilt, then 10 of those 11 would have to agree, at least 10 of those 11. It could be all 11, but it wouldn't have to be 11. It would need to be at least 10 of those 11, though, would have to agree to the enhancement in order for the enhancement to be proven.
So for the Blakely decision for the enhancement, you have the same requirement of at least a 10-2, knowing that at least 10 of those 11 have to make that decision.
That's correct.
And to complete this point, the same number of jurors are required for an enhancement as are required for the guilty.
That's correct. And the way that legislative counsel crafted the language, what they did was they didn't make reference to the specific number of jurors required for a particular conviction. And they did that upon the chair's request because we wanted to make the language here elastic enough to potentially apply in different contexts depending on what the courts do with the Blakely decision in the future. I think it's unlikely, but there's a possibility that there's talk of it applying to certain misdemeanor cases. There may be applicability that we don't really know about with respect to capital cases. There may be other changes in the law with respect to jury unanimity for run-of-the-mill felony cases. And while those are speculative, the bill, this section of the bill, I think, makes it clear that it's got to be the same number that are required to convict that at least must agree to the enhancement without making reference to the specific number.
So, Madam Chair, could I just follow up on, on that example? If you had a verdict that would require a 10-2 verdict, for, let's say, felony property crime,
mm-hmm.
and if you had 11-1 verdict and you're going for enhancement, it would take 11, or would it only take 10?
Only take 10 of the 11 that voted for guilt.
Okay.
Yeah. So if that one crossed over and a couple of them went sideways, that wouldn't do the job.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions of counsel or anybody else? We have Mr. French in the audience from the District Attorney's Office and Mr. Hummel if there are any other legal questions. Senator Whitsitt.
Have the defense lawyer signed off on this?
Well, that's a good question. Let's have them up and see if what they have to say. Mr. Hummel, did you want to come up? And Ms. Sky, I didn't notice you come in. you're the lucky one, huh?
Can I help you with that, Chair?
Well, you can answer Senator Whitsitt's question.
Certainly. Senator, I did not hear the question. Have the defense lawyers signed off on this, the Dash 10 amendment?
Oh, thank you, Senator. Not hardly. The defense bar is...
Identify yourself.
John Hummel with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. The defense bar is has signed off on every part of the bill but the retroactive part. We feel it's not appropriate to change the rules in the middle of the game, and for defendants who are presently in the system to change the rules of sentencing. So we think the bill should pass without the retroactivity part, Senator. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Do you have any other questions on that point, Senator Wissett? Okay. Well, I think might just take a flyer here and ask for a motion from Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 10 Amendment to Senate Bill 528.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 10 amendments to Senate Bill 528. Is there any discussion? Any objection?
Senator Reno. I'm going to object to the Dash 10 amendments.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. No, I think we're okay. Two objections. Why don't you call the roll, Dale?
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Senator Pruszynski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
No.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Four ayes, two nays, and one excused.
The Dash 10 amendments are adopted. Senator Starr?
Move. Senate Bill 528 is amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 528 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support the measure, but I am a little concerned about the fiscal support going to the floor now. But if we see a big fiscal on it when it gets to the floor, if they've changed it and determined that it's going to be in excess of $50,000, which it very well may could be, I would support at that point in time sending the bill through the Budget Committee to make sure that it is.
I appreciate that, Senator Beyer, and it's my understanding that fiscal, the indeterminate part of that fiscal is going to hold, and if that's otherwise, it would be my intention to bring it back. Any other discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, I'll support the bill, even with the retroactivity piece that I wish the bill did not contain that, but still I think we need the bill.
Thank you very much. Any other discussion? Any objection? Okay. So ordered. Senate Bill 528 is adopted. I will carry it, and I want to thank everybody who participated in this process, members of the committee, members of the audience, people who aren't here who were part of the work group. I personally think this is easily one of the most important things we'll do this session in Senate Judiciary. So thanks to all. Okay. We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1041. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 1041 comes to you from Senator Gordley, creates a civil cause of action against a person who has committed custody interference in either the first or second degree. States that a criminal conviction for custodial interference is prima facie evidence of liability if the plaintiff was injured by the defendant's unlawful action, allows the plaintiff to recover special and general damages, including damages for emotional distress, punitive damages, and reasonable attorney fees, allows an action to be commenced no more than 6 years after the violation, allows a person under 18 years who is entitled to bring an action to commence suit no more than 6 years after the violation. However, the statute of limitations does not run until the time the person has reached 18, and also tolls the statute of limitation if the person who is the subject of custodial interference was removed from the state, applies to causes of action whether arising before on or after the effective date of this act.
Thank you very much. Sean Cruz is here from Senator Gordley's office. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. For the record, my name is Sean Cruz, Senator Ravel Gordley's legislative aide, Senate District 23, Northeast and Southeast Portland. Senate Bill 1041 is Senator Gordon's 2005 priority bill. It is intended to provide a civil remedy for victims of the crime of child abduction and through this civil remedy to serve as a deterrent to future incidents in the state of Oregon. I'm going to make my remarks brief to defer to others who will speak to, and also we are working with LC right now and drafting some amendments to this bill, and our concern is that we're going to have the time to get that done and bring the bill back to you, you know, given that it's end of May. But there are some concerns. We were concerned about unintended consequences of the bill, and just wanted to let you be aware of that. There are some points that I want to make here.
Just very briefly, if you could, because we've got a really full agenda, and
okay.
We have testimony that's 5 pages long, and we have it in front of us. Thank you.
I just wanted to say that one of the most significant obstacles that families face following an abduction is the assumptions that law enforcement, the courts, members of the bar, and the general public impose on the issue. These assumptions minimize the impact of an abduction on a family in both the short and the long term, and completely ignore the emotional and financial devastation these families suffer. These assumptions form barriers you encounter in the justice system, at work, at home, and at every point in your life. Those assumptions are embodied in ORA statute in the form of statutes of limitations that are wholly inappropriate to the problem of child abduction, and to the fact that there is no civil remedy. Someone can come in and destroy your family, destroy your life, your future, your hopes for the future, and you have no legal recourse. So that being said, I'll conclude my testimony for now. Thank you very much.
And we do have your written comments. They're very good, and I appreciate you bringing them to us. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Let's see. Now we have Belisa Sidlick and Sybil Hebb.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Could I ask the council a question?
Please do.
We heard a bill dealing something with this issue earlier this session.
Senate Bill 251.
251, that was my question. What was the bill number?
That was a statute of limitations extension that we actually took up and did not have the support for.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to know if that, because I got a funny feeling there's probably a lot of testimony in that file that would be pertinent to this bill.
Yeah, what was the bill number?
Council, do you remember?
251. Thank you.
251.
That's okay. The correspondence I received from attorney at the Yale Law School.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Belisa Sidlick, Family Law Senior Policy Analyst with the Oregon Judicial Department, and I was also a member of Senator Gordley's Interim Task Force on Parental Abduction. The department takes no official position on Senate Bill 1041, and it certainly is not opposed to the policies that arise behind it. However, the department does have concerns that are related to the number of cases that may be filed if this bill passes as is. We believe that there will be quite a number of cases that will arise, and this is due to the fact that it's a very broad description of the kind of cases that can be filed. Anyone who alleges in an unlawful taking, enticing, or keeping of their child from them by a parent or third parties would be able to file a civil action. One of the problems is that in domestic relations cases, individuals with disputes over their children get into entangled and protracted litigation, and they seek litigation tools that they can use against each other. Our fear is that Senate Bill 1041 would provide them with an additional tool to use in this. In addition, the statute of limitations provides that actions can be brought for up to 6 years after the date of the act that constitutes the violation. And if the child or person is taken out of state, there is actually no statute of limitations. So this is also a factor that would contribute to the great number of cases that the court would see come into their courtrooms if Senate Bill 1041 passes. And lastly, there is a retroactive effect to the bill, and it would apply to cases that are filed. It would apply to cases and causes of action that arise before the effective date of the Act, as well as after the effective date of the Act. So understanding that there is a really positive and necessary and good intended purpose behind this bill, the department would like to encourage some amendments that would address limiting the cause of action to instances where there has been a criminal prosecution under ORS 163-245 or 163-257, to decrease the statute of limitations and to delete the exception for taking of the victim out of state and to eliminate the retroactive effect. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Counsel.
So, like, when you say prosecution, you mean conviction?
Not necessarily. It might be the filing of a case for violation of these statutes. I don't believe there are that many of them, actually, currently.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so what do you mean by filing? You mean by the district attorney? Or do you mean by a citizen coming in and filing something with the district attorney?
Madam Chair, Counsel Taylor, I would mean by filing by the prosecutor.
So the district attorney would have to decide to take the case and have to decide to begin prosecution.
Madam Chair, Counsel Taylor, that's correct.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
May I ask a question of our counselors?
Yes, sir.
The crime of custodial interference, does that require intent?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, Senator, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Ringo, yes, it does.
So let's say somebody was, you know, they were supposed to deliver their kids by 5 p.m. on Sunday and they were 15 minutes late. No intent, no custodial interference. We don't have a cause of action.
Madam Chair, I think in the background, I put forth, members of the committee, Senator Ringo, I actually put forth what the statute is, and the person commits the crime of custodial interference in either the first or second degree if the person, knowing or have reason to know that a person has no legal right to do so, takes another person from the other person's lawful custody, in violation of a valid custody order, with the intent to hold the other person permanently or for a protracted period.
For a protracted period.
Right.
I see. What's the definition of a protracted period?
Madam Chairman of the committee, Senator Ringo, Senator Beyer, I believe you would look to Webster's Unabridged Dictionary for the definition of a protracted period. It's not defined in the statute. I believe a court would give it its ordinary meaning, and in doing so, we'll go to Webster's Unabridged Dictionary.
Which we don't have.
Which I can go and get in the library.
We only have Black's Law Dictionary.
Well, assuming that somebody ever listens to this tape of our discussion, are we looking more like a few hours or a few days or a few weeks?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what is the sense of the committee on that? If they do look to discussion here, then it would be better for the committee to say something rather than for me to try to answer that question.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, these things get very emotional, and often parents do unreasonable things because they are so emotional. And I don't do family law. I used to volunteer in a family law clinic, and I saw a lot of horrible situations. And let me just give a hypothetical. Let's say that one parent didn't return the child as they were supposed to the evening, but they kept the kid overnight. And then the next day, they say, okay, here. I don't know if that's a protracted period. I don't know if that's the intent of this, but I think if that's giving rise to cause of action, I think we need to think carefully about that, particularly when there's an attorney fees clause. Because when you have an attorney fees clause on a relatively minor infraction, and maybe that's not minor, but sometimes litigation becomes about who's going to pay for the other's attorney fees. And then it's very hard to settle a case when you're in that situation. And I just put that on the table as a concern that when you have attorney fees clauses, it's not always good. Sometimes it leads to more litigation.
Appreciate your comments. I think that's something that we should look into, is trying to narrow down a little bit more what we're talking about. And by getting a nod from the front row. Yeah.
Correct.
I think we know it when we see it, and we just got to make sure it says it. Are there any other questions, Senator Pazansky?
Madam Chair, I guess really for Senator Ringo, it sounds like one of the questions you're asking is there a predicate necessary for a criminal conviction before the civil action?
I think that's not true. I think the counsel said you don't need a conviction.
That's correct.
You need a charge.
Right.
I believe that statement came from the witness of the courts.
Madam Chair, maybe for the witness.
That's what they were requesting concerning an amendment.
What's a typical case where custodial interference charges are brought in a criminal context?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, unfortunately, I criminal practice is not my forte. I am in the area of family law. I understand there are not very many of these, and that prosecution is rather loath to take them because of the complexity and difficulty, the emotional difficulties involved. And I think they have to be quite dire for charges to be filed.
Right. Like overnight, for example, you wouldn't expect charges. Sybil's shaking her head no.
Sybil hasn't had a chance to testify yet.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not a criminal attorney either, but that's my impression, understanding from my experience.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pazansky.
I guess back to Senator Ringo, when you look at the bill under Section 1, Sub 1, Line 4, it says irrespective of any criminal prosecution or the result thereof. And so the reality, there doesn't even have to be actual charges going forward before the civil action could commence. And I've got, I assume we received the testimony that came in from the University of Oregon Law School, Professor Winner. That basically makes some of these points in her testimony because she couldn't be here in person. And if the committee did not receive that, I've got two copies. I'll make sure that it gets filed. Yeah.
And I believe the way I heard your testimony, you were suggesting that as a change to the bill, not as the bill stands. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. Other questions before we move to Ms. Hebb?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, and I just wanted to draw the committee's attention to one of the points that Professor Reiner made in her testimony, which I think gets at the idea of further narrowing the scope of cases by providing a defense for circumstances in which a person was perhaps intentionally away or taking a child away from another custodian, but because for some lawful and appropriate reason related to protecting the physical safety of either the child or that parent. And so I would just encourage the committee to also take that into consideration. I've spoken with Mr. Cruz about that as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Counsel, you just burst in with information.
Right, Madam Chair. This is Webster's Unabridged Dictionary, okay? and according to Webster's Unabridged, protracted means drawn out in time, prolonged.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Yeah, look up for. I think that we need to have some specific guidance in this bill. And I'm not sure what the right amount is, whether it's 2 weeks or a month, but I think that's got to be in the bill.
I agree. And I would encourage all the people who are here, Sean, to work with folks. And you already mentioned you were bringing some amendments. Senator Starr.
Yes, I agree that we perhaps need to visit this and try to bring some clarity, but circumstances surrounding individual situations demand different levels of concern. And so protracted, where there's serious concerns about relationship, might simply be overnight.
Well, maybe.
And if it was not where there's reason to have serious concerns, it might be 3 weeks or a different time limit. So I think it's going to be a hard place for us to come down so that we word that in a way that allows discretion. So I'd be pretty sensitive about that personally.
Maybe we could take a cue from the 14 in the U.S. Senate and say set a timeline except under extraordinary circumstances, Senator Starr. For those who've been reading the paper.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much. We look forward to seeing what you come up with. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 1041 and open a hearing. Before we do that, committee, Senator Starr, I would appreciate a motion to suspend the rules to allow Senator Walker to vote on Senate Bill 528.
Madam Chair, I move that we suspend the rules to allow Senator Walker to vote on Senate Bill 528. Will not change the outcome.
Objections? So, Senator Walker, how do you vote?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity. I was in another committee presenting another bill, and I'm delighted to vote aye on this bill because it's very important work that we've done here. So thank you for that opportunity.
Glad to have you on the record, Senator Walker. Okay, with that bit of business completed, we will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 392, and we are honored with the presence of Senator Ben Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ben Westland, Senate District 22nd, or 27th. Senate District 27.
Where are you from?
Well, just for the record, Madam Chair, I would not have allowed Vicki Walker to vote on that last bill. But
we know. That's why we did it in front of you, just to bug you.
Madam Chair, a very sincere thank you for allowing this very important bill to come forward. Important because it closes some significant loopholes in Oregon's Slayer statute that prohibits criminal perpetrators from benefiting financially from their crimes. Let me tell you a sad but unfortunately very true story. 5 years ago, this coming October, a normal Central Oregon family went out camping in New Lawis, a husband, a wife, a child, a family. But unlike normal family vacations, this one ended in tragedy, indeed murder. Lisa, the wife, drugged her husband, Chris, sedated him, and tried at first unsuccessfully to drown him. She then tasered him, and eventually shot him in the head while their young son was a mere 30 feet away in their car. Law enforcement got lucky on this case as they were able to recover Lisa's computer where she had written several screenplays outlining about how women would go about murdering their husband. Lisa was convicted with a plea bargain and she now sits in prison. The boy, now still under 10 years of age, lives with his grandparents in Central Oregon, Robert and Janie Werther. It is for them and for this young boy that I bring you this bill. They are concerned. They are very concerned for the well-being of this child. They are concerned that the person who murdered their son could benefit financially from his death. If anything were to happen to this boy before he reaches his 18th birthday, his estate under current law would go to the mother, go to the murderer. And in this case, since Ann Rule, the famous criminal novelist, wrote about this grisly crime, there are significant assets to be obtained through whatever means legal or otherwise, or even normal accidents that could just befall any young boy. This loophole in the Slayer statute needs to be closed, not just in this and for this particular case, but for all victims, their families, and most importantly, for justice. Madam Chair, again, thank you so very much for allowing this important bill to come forward. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for bringing this to us, Senator Wessel. We've had a number of bills brought to us on the same line of not letting abusers, or in this case murderers, benefit from their crimes. And you kind of have to ask yourself how that it ever got to be that way in the first place. I did have a question. In the bill, it has an exception if the heir or devisee specifically provides otherwise in a will. And I'm just wondering if you have any concerns about pressure or other kinds of ways of coercing somebody that might get around the intent of this bill.
I think that is a concern, Madam Chair. I understand your bringing that question up. At least in that case, that circumstance, there would be the free will of an individual, in this case a minor, who would be represented by counsel. So at least there would be a rational process that was gone through before any estate planning, if you will, for a youngster, or assets were signed over to, in this case, a murderer. What is lacking in the current law is if there is no written record of what assets of a minor, how they should be dispersed. That's what this bill attempts to address, and I believe that portion of the bill is current law. I could be wrong on that. Maybe we could ask either Bill or Joe to comment.
Counsel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is current law as it relates to the Slayer. What is unusual in the factual circumstances here, and I actually had to call Dave Hendricks to go through the bill with me and figure it out, because this is a complicated area. This is a situation where a person kills, like it was mentioned here, a wife kills husband. Under current law, the wife cannot inherit from the husband because she has murdered the husband. What then happens is all the property passes to his only heir, his son. A person under 18 cannot execute a will, and they're old enough. So if the son were to die, his only heir would be his mother. So the mother, who's in prison, who could not otherwise inherit, could inherit from the son. So she would be getting the husband's property, the husband that she murdered, indirectly. And this is what this issue is geared at. And I believe that there is a provision, I'd have to pull the statute again, where you can, by will, work around this. So, but as the senator said, it would be a something the person would have to do knowingly and freely.
Okay, so counsel, to follow up on that, are you saying because someone under 18 can't execute a will, then this phrase on line 13 saying that if the heir or devisee provides otherwise, they'd have to be over 18?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
Oh, well, that's reassuring.
If I could, Madam Chair, William, what happens if the proceeds, say, in this case, and I do not know this specifically, so I'm speaking hypothetically, I know Ann Rule wrote a book on this case, a significant portion of the proceeds of that book went to the son. What happens if those are established in trust? I don't know how those assets were distributed to the son, but what happens if a trust was set up for the benefit of that boy, you know, until he would turn 18 or 21 or 26. I'm still assuming that if something happened to that individual with no will, then they would transfer to the mother.
Unless we had a bill to say otherwise.
Yeah, unless we had a
right.
Bill to correct that.
Right.
Council, do you have?
Madam Chair, in this situation, if the son were to die, then I assume under this bill, the property would go to his grandparents.
Well, that's what I was saying.
And assuming, unless he had, they're the only heirs that he has, because it would pass intestate. Since he can't make a will, it can still pass intestate. And this bill would cut off the parent receiving through intestate.
This bill?
Yes.
But without this bill?
Without this bill, Madam Chair, then on the current law, if his kid dies, without this bill passing, then his mother would take the intestacy.
Madam Chair, if I could ask counsel, that's my understanding, even if they're just guardians, because guardians don't get inheritance rights, and I don't know if these have the grandparents adopted their grandson as their own child, but I doubt that.
Madam Chair, they would be guardians, but they're also blood relatives, mm-hmm. and they would take. It's been a long time since I looked at this. The last time I really looked at it closely was I took a bar exam. but I do remember that people who are blood relatives by blood or by law, mm-hmm. for example, if there was another child in the house that was adopted, that would be a by law, a sibling,
mm-hmm.
and that adopted child would take equally.
Mm-hmm.
The grandparents are, you know, either by blood or by law, direct, will inherit from a grandchild.
But the mother, because the mother's still alive, she gets it first.
And Chairman of the Committee, that is correct. Without this mm-hmm. bill, they would, mother would take first, and mother would benefit. Now, obviously, this is not something that the drafters of the original law, 112-465, contemplated. It's not something that happens that often, I hope.
Well, one would hope not.
But you do have a real-life situation in front of you, so.
Okay, you're talking me into an emergency clause here. Okay.
Madam Chair, I think that's an exceptional improvement to the bill. I think it should be obvious to all that the reason this problem and condition exists is because Bill hasn't looked at this since, you know, he took his bar exam.
Right? You have to be nice to counsel when you come to judiciary, Senator Westland. Okay, thank you, Senator Westland. Are there any other questions? Okay, is there anybody else in the audience who wants to speak on this? We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 392. I'd like to look into this a little bit more and would intend to move this at a later time.
Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming. Okay. For those in the audience, I apologize for my late notice here, but we are going to move Senate Bill 1025 to next Tuesday's meeting. I apologize for not announcing that at the beginning. That is what is going to happen for those who haven't already gotten word. Okay. What do we do next? Should we finish up with you? 424.
That's Jill's bill. I may be through.
Okay, we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1050. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1050 comes to you from the Committee on Rules. You have the -3 amendments in front of you. It modifies the eligibility for child support requirements of a child attending school. That is a child 18 years of age or older and under 21 years of age. You have the -3 amendments that clarify that a child attending school may apply for services from the Support Enforcement Division. States that a child is 18 years of age or older and under 21 years of age is a necessary party to divorce, parenting time plan, or petition for support modifications. If a parent established a higher education savings plan for child continuing education, a court may order payment from that plan. Takes effect upon passage, requires disclosure of school records for will be consistent with state and federal requirements concerning the disclosure of school records. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the last sentence is what's the difference between the -2 and the -3 amendments.
And the -3 amendments replace the -2.
They replace the -2, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right.
You have people here from the Department of Justice Support and
Enforcement Division, I'm sure would be glad to elaborate upon what I've said.
Why don't you come on up, Rennell, in case people have questions? And Shaney. We start having work session sign-ups here. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks for the record, Madam Chair. I'm Shankle with the Attorney General's Office. As a reminder, this is a bill that comes to you. There was much work actually done by Senator Brown and her staff, and she solicited the assistance of the Department of Justice, including our Division of Child Support, and you have amendments before you today. Briefly, the bill is originally drafted. The intent was that we have had the child attending school laws on the book in Oregon since 1997. They have a lot of administrative processes built into them, and what we are finding is that as more time passes, the law itself is not clear, and the legislative intent is starting to fade. So we would like to clarify these statutes. This is not looking at making a significant policy change in the area of child attending school, but getting the statutes cleaner and clearer so that practitioners, courts, child support, case managers, and everyone will be able to use them in the same manner. We have worked with, as I said, Senator Brown's staff, ourselves, the Judicial Department, the State Bar has been reviewing it, but has no particular position. You had a letter, as you might recall, at the public hearing from Judge Raines, and we've also worked with the Oregon University System. So many players who are involved in this area have looked at these amendments, and I'll let Shaney tell you briefly the highlights, and then if you want particular, she's happy to walk you through the technical aspects.
Okay, before you start, I wanted to see if Hans wanted to join us. Okay, we'll wait on that. Welcome.
Okay, thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Shaney Fuller, and I'm with the Department of Justice Oregon Child Support Program. As Ms. Schenkel mentioned, the current law has certain really technical requirements for reporting, and what we found is that there is a large focus not on whether the child is actually attending school and in need of assistance to do that, but on whether the child has met those technical requirements. And so that is really the focus of the changes that we're making here. Just to point out a few of the major changes, it will remove the requirement to maintain the equivalent of a C grade average and require the child to maintain satisfactory academic progress. That is a term already defined by the institutions for financial aid purposes. It will remove the requirement that the child report to the parent and the division within the first 30 days of each term or semester, and instead will provide the parent with a written consent so that the parent can actually contact the school and find out that information if they want to have it. If a child between 18 and 21 fails to qualify at some point in time, and then before they turn age 21, they requalify or start attending school again, and that support can be reinstated. And that is probably the largest change here that we find. People really focus on whether those technical requirements are met, because as the division interprets it, we aren't able to reinstate that support obligation, so parents really lie in wait for the child to mess up on the reporting requirements so that their support can be cut off. As stated, we have worked through Senator Brown's office with many entities and individuals in coming up with the amendments. We think that that reflects the agreement of all of the involved parties that will be affected by this law. And quickly, it clarifies the party rights of a child attending school to really ensure that the child is notified of any legal proceeding that may affect their rights. We worked with Oregon University Systems to ensure that that written consent for disclosure meets the terms of federal law. And finally, we worked with the Treasurer's Office to state that a judge could go outside the provisions of ORS 107-108 and allow payment of support from a higher education savings plan. Those tax plans are something that parents utilize now and would like to use instead of the ORS 107-108 provision. And finally, there is an emergency clause contained in the amendment. It will be effective upon passage, but operational on September 1, 2005. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
Does this apply to intact families?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, it does not apply to intact families. And specifically, there is a policy statement included. It's clarified in the amendments that states that this is specifically for support of non-intact families and those families where a child has been removed from the home. And that is in line with the Crocker decision that came down here a few years ago to state that legislators could make the decision to provide support for those children specifically for child support. And that was the intent at the time, and we've just simply put that intent, as we understood it, into the law as a policy statement.
Senator Starr.
Probably more a statement than a question. I've had the opportunity to go through education of four sons. Told them often that I would help them earn a college education, but that I would not be contributing to their college education. I have real serious problems requiring of a divorce parent that which we don't require of an intact family, and so I'm going to be opposing this piece of legislation. I think it goes beyond what we should be doing. I know there's strong feelings about education and the cost thereof, but I just feel like that we're making an imposition here that we don't require of all families, and I think it's unnecessary and uncalled for. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Do you have any...
Chair Burdick, may I add, Senator Starr, my apologies. I don't think we have clarified, and maybe this will not sway your decision, but let me make very clear. This bill does nothing to change that existing policy decision, and Shani can speak more about the Crocker case if you wish, with regard to whether or not these children are entitled to support. What this law is attempting to do, or I should say this bill is attempting to do, is as long as we continue to have that law in the book, we are requesting that you help us at least clarify, including that policy statement, so that we have more consistency of procedures.
Thank you. Council?
Madam Chair, I was going to say the same thing. Shankle, how long has this law been on the books? Because I know every session I've been here, we've modified this, I've gone through this bill, this law.
Chair Burdick and Mr. Taylor, unfortunately, I don't have my statute book in front of me. I apologize. It has been on the books for many years in Oregon. 1997 was not a new law. It was simply the last and greatest revision, but it predates the 90s and has been in the Oregon statutes for quite some time.
This doesn't necessarily, I mean, the law doesn't, I mean, isn't the obligation to pay a child's college expenses determined by the divorce decree? That's not established by law, is it?
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, that is an important point to make. This is not a dollar-for-dollar reimbursement of educational expenses. This still requires a dissolution, administrative order, some type of support order that contains a provision for monthly child support and then language that it will continue during college, and that is based on the Oregon Child Support Guidelines, not on the cost of the college.
So this pertains to child support, and I'm not sure this is going to alleviate your concern, Senator Starr, but I think it's an important point that you raise. This applies to the support of the child and not tuition or college expense. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick, that is correct. That is how the calculation is done, based on the actual costs of continuing to raise a child and providing home, food, and shelter for those periods when they are not at college, or perhaps they still live at home during college, yes.
Okay, so does our law currently make people obligated for child support in all cases till a child's 21?
Chair Burdick, no. The statute, in the language of the statute, is actually discretionary, although I will add that in most cases it is added to the terms of the dissolution decree or a child support order entered by the child support program.
It's the terms of the divorce decree that determine whether there are support obligations between 18 and 21. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick, that is correct.
Well, Madam Chair, I think it helps me understand we got some bad laws on the books.
Okay. Are there any other questions from the committee? Senator Whitsitt, you look perplexed.
He looks pensive.
Pensive.
I'll find out later.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I don't know. Are there other concerns on the committee?
I hate the bill.
You hate the bill?
What did you say?
I said I hate the bill and the amendment.
Yeah. I think there are some concerns about this bill. I think we're going to, for the moment, close the work session on Senate Bill 1050. And we will open... We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 424. Counsel. Whoever's doing this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Senate Bill 424 was brought before us on the 11th of May. This is the bill that would give the court discretion in awarding temporary custody of the party's children when the court is issuing a family abuse protective order. Under current law, the court is required by statute to give temporary custody of the children to the petitioner when granting a FAPA order, unless the petitioner specifically asks the court to grant custody to the respondent. This bill has before you a dash 2 amendment that changes the language of the original draft slightly. And what it would do is it would still allow court discretion, but it puts a little more sidebars on it. The dash 2 would allow the court, when making that consideration of whether to grant temporary custody of the child to one of the parties in the FAPA proceeding, to consider the particular circumstances affecting the child and to make a determination as to whether those circumstances require additional information before granting temporary custody. If the court makes that determination, that basically it needs more information, then a hearing would have to be held within 5 days after the respondent to the FAPA order is served. And the dash 2 permits the court to make any order that is designed to maintain the child's welfare pending that hearing that has to be within 5 days of service, but the court is limited from modifying any pre-existing custody order.
Okay, this has been a really complicated issue. Maybe we could have Civil Heb come on up and whoever else has been working on this. Thank you. You guys have really worked hard on this. Can you just kind of give us a little more guidance on what you've done in the dash 2 amendments here? Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Belissa Seidlick, Family Law Senior Policy Analyst with the Oregon Judicial Department. And the dash 2 amendments, I believe Sybil Hebb has provided you, have you, Sybil, with a brief one-pager that describes what Counsel O'Leary set forth as what the dash 2s accomplish. And basically, I believe that while judges would prefer to have the discretion up front, initially in the proceeding, to determine what is in the best interests of the child and what's in the best interests of the parties, this is an option that, while lesser preferred, still restores to them some discretion and permits them in those instances where a petitioner is actually the potential abuser or perhaps a person who is not the primary caretaker of the child. It permits the judges to take some time, order the parties to come to a hearing, and in the interim, make pendente lite orders until a further order of the court could be made. The feedback that I've heard from judges is that this is an option that they would encourage the committee to take into consideration, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
And this is for, I'm sure, the very small percentage of cases where an abuser is manipulating the system by getting to the courthouse first to apply for an order, and then they're first in line for custody of the child. And this is, do these cases happen very often?
Madam Chair, no, they don't. And as a matter of fact, attached to my testimony is the written testimony of four of our judges, and I have heard from a number of other judges, and I believe it's Judge Brady from Deschutes who indicates that in her experience, this is about 5% of the cases that come before her where an abuse of the system is taking place.
So it's pretty tight requirements that you have in the dash two. I mean, it would take a considerable effort, wouldn't it, but for the judge to overturn the presumption that the child goes with the person filing for the order.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, it would certainly, you would see a situation where the judge would ask for additional information to be provided. He or she would have both parties before them in making a decision. So it would be considerably more detailed.
I really, Sybil, did you want to say some more about this, or do the committee members have questions before we move to Sybil? Thank you. Why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. I appreciate that. I do have actually quite a bit to say. I'll try to be as brief as I can.
Could you identify yourself?
I apologize. Sybil Head with the Oregon Law Center. I'm presenting my comments today on behalf of the Law Center, but also on behalf of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence and the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women. And we appreciate the effort that the Judicial Department has gone to help us take a look at providing a remedy to meet the needs in that what we agree is probably 5% of the cases. We respect and acknowledge that there are circumstances in which people try to misuse the restraining order process. We do think it is very clearly a small amount of cases, and we think that the interests and the issues that are at stake in providing a change to the statute are great. This statutory provision is the most important piece of legislation for domestic violence survivors that we have, and it's something that we hold dearly and that we think provides real essential life-saving help to victims. And the reason that we're particularly concerned about the custody provisions are that we know, and I think you may have seen in testimony submitted by Professor Wiener from the University of Oregon previously, that the fear of losing children or of subjecting children to physical violence is one of the greatest barriers to victims taking the steps to leave. We also know that statistics have shown us, and I have a study that's quoted in my materials, statistics have shown us that those fears are not without cause, that when a victim takes the steps to leave an abusive situation, that the lethality of the abuse and the potential lethality increases substantially, and that's true for the abuse towards the adult as well as towards the children. And so these are real and serious issues at stake. And so for that reason, we feel strongly that the current state of the law is not perfect, but does do the best job of balancing those very serious safety issues with the process issues that the judges have pointed out do occur. And right now, under the current law, there is the requirement that the courts hold a hearing within 5 days whenever a respondent requests such a hearing on the issue of custody. And we have seen in our experience that there are some times when that initial custody order is made in a way that probably could have been avoided
avoided, but we also see that it gets remedied quickly, and we think the safety issues at stake are great enough that that it's an appropriate balance in the current, under the current law. However, if the committee decides to make a change to the current law, we have had the privilege of working with the Judicial Department, with the Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, with advocates from the programs and domestic violence programs from across the state, and we've had a chance to get really good input, and we've come up with a proposal, which is in the Dash 2 amendments, that does provide, if there is to be a change, we think the best balance, the best protection for victims while also addressing the judge's concerns. And so if the committee did decide to make a move, we do support these amendments as a move. And I realize I'm not giving you that much direction because I think our clear preference is to stay with the current state of the law. And if there is a decision to move, then we appreciate the Dash 2 amendments. I guess in my conversations, I spoke with family law attorney Sean Wardinsky, who does training for the National Council of Juvenile and Family Law Judges, and she does trainings across the nation on misuse of restraining order procedures. And nationally, there is evidence that this happens in something between 2 and 5% of cases. And the studies have shown that that's not inconsistent with misuse, unfortunately, of other sorts of provisions as well. And so we don't think this is inconsistent, and we don't think that the risk is so great that it justifies a significant reduction in the relief that's currently available to victims. I want to be very clear to support the chair's comments that I think it is our intent, and I believe it's the intent of the Judicial Department, that if this change were to move forward, it would be something that would be used in a very narrow set of circumstances. And for that reason, we think that if the committee did decide to move forward with this amendment, we would strongly urge that there be some direction that we provide significant information and outreach to practitioners as well as advocates and judges and court staff about the change and the intent and how it's intended to be applied. And we also strongly urge that the committee provide direction to the department to help keep track of these cases and when this option is put into place. And so if we're hearing from the judges that 5% of these cases are inappropriately filed, then we'd like to be sure that it's 5%, that there's some mirror in the use of this new option with the sense that the law is currently being misused. So we appreciate the current balance best, and we think that is the most protective of victims and of children. We do respect the Judicial Department's concerns, and if the committee decides to move forward with these amendments, then we would appreciate some direction. And we have spoken with the Judicial Department about the issue of training and of data collection, and I believe we have their commitment to work on these issues, and we would offer our assistance if the committee moves forward in that direction.
Great, and I'd like to offer the committee's assistance if we can help in any way. We will certainly, if this bill goes through, make that very clear in the caring statement that these are for extraordinary circumstances, a small minority of circumstances, so that the intent of the actual law is, in the effect of the actual law, is a good one. It's only in a small number of cases where someone's manipulating the system, but it can have very tragic results. And the way I see this bill is it provides just a safety valve for those cases that judges can see and feel terrible about not being able to do anything about. So, okay. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Senator Walker.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I've had both these women talking to me in the last couple of days. And I was reading some information in the file. It sounds like they're getting closer with some sideboards. So I think we can probably get there, and I agree with you. I mean, to take a child away from a newborn away from a breastfeeding mother because the father got to the courthouse before the mother and filed the restraining order, I don't like that idea. So I think we need to fix the problem, and so I think we just need a little more conversation, and we can get back here quickly.
Okay. Senator Walker, I hear that you're comfortable with the dash two amendments, or that you feel that we need to...
I'm comfortable with the sideboards that Ms. Hebb has talked about. So if we give some clear direction from this committee about what we expect to go along with that.
It's my understanding, Ms. Hebb, that you were referring to the dash two amendments as being the sideboards.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and Senator Walker. That is correct. I was referring to the dash two amendments, although there is not language in the dash two amendments that specifically talks about training and outreach or data collection. And so I believe that, was that what you were referring to, Senator Walker?
That's exactly what I'm referring to. So if that's not in the bill and you want it in there, then we need a dash three, because I think that's, I understand the concerns on both sides, and it's really hard to come together on this one. And I think I can come together on a dash two if we have that sideboarding. If we need it in the bill, then that's the way we do it. But I don't know what the rest of the committee is feeling about.
Well, it's just, I guess my concern, we certainly want it done, but I'm a little concerned at this late date that if we put really specific language in, we may end up with a fiscal on this. And do you have any...
Madam Chair, if I may interject something. Sybil and I have talked about this commitment to further training, and as well in the past year and a half, and Sybil is aware of this as well, the Judicial Department has undertaken what we refer to as mandatory domestic violence data entry protocols, whereby we take a look at the kinds of activities that go on around FAPA, and we could easily include an event code that incorporates this type of hearing. And so I don't think it's something that necessarily needs to be legislated at this point. It is something I feel comfortable committing to on the record on behalf of the department.
Well, I appreciate that very much, and if we invited you back a few months into the interim for a report, you would have something to tell us.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Walker, are you?
Ms. Hebb seems to want to speak, so I'm going to let her do that before I speak. Chair, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and Senator Walker, members of the committee. I agree. We have had conversations, and I am familiar with the data entry protocols that Ms. Sedlick is speaking about, and I think if there's clear direction from this committee that there are, and maybe the appropriate compromise is to have some language in the statute that could just direct a report back so that everybody was sort of able to look at the results of that at the same time, that might be helpful.
Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, that's a delay of a couple, several days. I don't know that you want to do that. We could send it out of this committee with that understanding that we add that in on the House. I mean, I don't know if you feel that we're at that point in the session where we want to waste a day or two.
That would be fine with me.
Well, I mean, we could. I'd rather, if we need language, I'd rather do it now. I'm just nervous about how it might contribute to a fiscal. Counsel, did you have a comment?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Can't wiggle your hands around this place.
Madam Chair, we've got a 38-page amendment that's been given to us today. It sounds like there's some concerns as to whether it has everything that it needs. If there's a concern about some type of fiscal appearing after it, if it's done later, it seems to me, aren't we just basically, it just seems like we're walking down a path that we should address it now if we've got an issue, and knowing what we're actually asking them to do. There's no emergency clause on here, so we're not going to get any interim report in a couple of months. I mean, this won't even go into effect until January of next year. So the earliest we're going to hear anything back is in 2006. So, Madam Chair, I've got some concerns about just pushing something out. I'm hearing hesitation. I've got hesitation just not fully appreciating, knowing that there's been comment on the original bill. I'd like to see if we can't allow for a couple of days to allow the people who comment on the first bill draft, specifically from the University of Oregon's Law School, that raised some pretty significant issues as to whether this takes care of those concerns that they raised.
Okay, well, why don't we try to come up with something that
we've discussed here in terms of keeping track of the experience. And I'm sure you are in contact with the folks from U of O, and maybe we can get a little more of that. I think it's worth the time to make sure we get it right on this, because the stakes are pretty high in this whole area. So we will close the... Senator Pazansky.
Senator Whitsitt.
Just a comment. I'm not sure why we would take the position that the presiding judges should not or should be restrained from making an informed decision as to immediate custody. I mean, that's what judges are for. And
I love you for saying that.
You have to reflect my bias, Senator Whitsitt.
Judges have been neutered many times by this legislative process. So
this is opening up a little more discretion for them in this area.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So thank you very much for that comment. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 424. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1047. Council.
Madam Chair, is 1047 the fatality, domestic violence fatality review?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think you intended to...
We are going to move Senate Bill 1047 to some time to be determined in the 48-hour notice period, because my judge, Judge Kosh, would like to comment on this. Apologize for that. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1059.
And what?
59 on the second.
Oh, there's more on the back.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1059 deals with juveniles who are found either guilty except for insanity or found mentally incompetent to stand trial and find themselves committed to or being dealt with in adult criminal court. This happens either one of two different ways, either when a juvenile is charged with a Measure 11 offense or when a juvenile is waived into adult court by the juvenile court for a variety of different charges. However, that is much less frequent than juveniles who are charged with Measure 11. In any case, juvenile in adult court, criminal court, may assert either that they are incompetent to stand trial or may assert the insanity defense, as it is known in Oregon, guilty except for insanity. In either event, current law requires a commitment to the state mental hospital of those juveniles if the court finds that the individual was guilty except for insanity or is unable to aid and assist. What this bill would do would be to amend that law to allow the psychiatric security review, excuse me, to allow the Department of Human Services to designate a secure inpatient facility that those juveniles may be committed to rather than the state hospital.
Given the headlines we've been reading.
And I should add, too, that there is a -1 and a -2 amendment. I believe that both would probably be necessary. The -1 makes just a minor clarification, making clear that the Psychiatric Security Review Board, when conditionally releasing a person under 18 from their jurisdiction, may place the youth into any range of community mental health treatment facilities. It's correcting an error that was, I believe, made in the original bill. The sponsors can speak more to that. And then the -2 amendment creates an emergency clause so that the measure would be effective upon passage. And my understanding is that this is a concern because if a juvenile were adjudicated in adult criminal court right now, the current state of the law is that they would go to the state hospital. And I believe that the state hospital has closed the wing or the unit which had formerly housed juveniles in this posture.
Thank you. And we have Bill Buska here.
Madam Chair.
Buska. Senator Beyer.
Is this a rewrite of the bill we heard earlier this session also?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I think you're referring to the juvenile PSRB bill.
The PSRB.
The Psychiatric Security Review Board. And there's another one you might be referring to, too, which is on the agenda for work session today, 2141. 2141 is kind of the flip side of this same coin. 2141 has to do with youths who are in OYA custody or some adult inmates who are in DOC custody who are committed to the state hospital. And this one, 1059, only has to do with the youths who are committed to the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. But the earlier bill I mentioned that we heard very early on in the session was an Oregon Law Commission bill that would actually create a juvenile psychiatric security review board. That would apply to youth who are charged in juvenile court, not who end up in adult criminal court, but would allow youth in juvenile court to assert the GEI defense, and it would create a procedure for their disposition because none currently exists.
Your question, I had the same question when this initially came up. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Buska, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Bill Buska. I'm the team leader of the Children's Treatment System for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1059 with the -1 and -2 amendments. This statutory change is critical to allow certain persons under the age of 18 to receive treatment and evaluation in a setting other than the Oregon State Hospital. As you heard earlier by Council Leary, the adolescent program at the Oregon State Hospital has closed, and in March of this year, our office developed a secure adolescent inpatient program that is designed and operated to provide the appropriate mental health evaluation, treatment, and public safety necessary to meet the statutory requirements. And it allows the Department of Human Services to designate a secure intensive community inpatient facility for this purpose. The program that we've designed and is being operated really is provides all the services to adolescents that were previously provided at the Oregon State Hospital. And this is a cleanup of the statute to allow that to occur. Again, our office is highly supportive of Senate Bill 1059, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee?
Just one.
Senator Walker.
Madam Chair, Mr. Buska, is this as a result of closing Ward 40?
Senator Walker, Chair Burdick, that is correct.
So we have no more children in that horrid environment at Ward 40 at the State Hospital, is that correct?
Senator Walker, Chair Burdick, that is correct. March 1st, we began to close the unit and move the adolescents to the new program, which is in Corvallis. And so there are no longer adolescents at that program, or at the Oregon State Hospital.
And, Madam Chair, could I follow up?
Please do.
Are these children in Corvallis now, or are they elsewhere? I'm sorry, I didn't catch your testimony about that.
Senator Walker, Chair Burdick, the adolescents who were previously treated at the Oregon State Hospital are being served at the Secure Adolescent Inpatient Program in Corvallis. And this is critical for us now. We found out through the court process in Multnomah County that there was a youth who was being not able to aid and assist, and we were able to work with the court to have the youth released to this new program. And luckily enough, we found out early enough that there wasn't a commitment to the Oregon State Hospital, but this is pretty important for us so adolescents who are in the process right now don't get committed to the state hospital.
That's where I can do this too.
Madam Chair, thank you. If you recall, we had a discussion under Senate Bill 324 about the children in Ward 40, and I'm very glad to see the end of Ward 40.
Me too, Senator Walker. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Curious to know where you got the statutory authority to move these kids when the law says they have to be in the state hospital.
There is a part of 161.370 that allows the court to release the person under conditions, and so there we were able to work with the court to identify conditions of that release and supervision and identify the location and who would do the supervision and the reporting back to the court.
Bill. You don't really need the bill if you got ways you can do without, if you can break the law without changing the law. You don't really need the bill.
Senator Byard and Chair Burdick, there are two different options for the court within the statute today. One allows the court to commit the person to the Oregon State Hospital. And the other part allows the court to release the person under supervision. And it is more normal for, as I understand it, for under that statute, for the person to go to the Oregon State Hospital for that aid and assist evaluation and treatment and report back to the court. That would be the normal course of events for a court. We were able to find out early enough and talk to both the court and the defense and prosecuting attorney and let them know about our situation and the how we've set up the program and the security and the ability for the program to provide the necessary services to the court.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions from the committee, counsel?
Madam Chair, thank you. To address Senator Byers' question, too, and the example that the witness is referring to is an aid and assist hold or an evaluation to determine whether or not an individual can aid and assist, and there the court has the discretion to determine whether or not that that evaluation is going to happen at the state hospital or in a conditional release setting. The court does not have that same kind of discretion in the other part of this bill, which is a commitment to the Psychiatric Security Review Board. If the court determines that the person is convicted of the predicate type of felony involving the threat or use of physical injury or causing a physical injury, and the court determines that the person is a danger. Mary Claire Buckley will be here and correct me if I'm wrong. I believe the court has to order commitment to the PSRB, and the PSRB has to order that the individual be placed at the state hospital currently. So I don't think there's any wiggle room when it comes to that prong of this bill.
Okay.
The current law.
Well, then, of the current people that got moved out of the state hospital, were some of them under that part of it?
I can't speak to that for sure, but in my conversations earlier with Mary Claire Buckley, my understanding is that if the individual is later determined to not be a danger, then the board can conditionally release the person. But in a case that would happen, I mean, hypothetically, if a case happened today and the court made a determination that the child who's being tried as an adult is a danger, and they're within the jurisdiction of the board, I don't think the board would have any flexibility but to commit the child to the state hospital.
But, Madam Chair, it doesn't sound like council knows if there's any of those.
Yeah, I think we have Mary Claire Buckley in the audience, and maybe she would be the one to address your questions. Are you willing to do that? Dangerous to show up at Senate Judiciary. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Senator Byard, with regards to your question, there were individuals under the board at the hospital when it was going to be closed. The board had the legal option to conditionally release those individuals to this new secure adolescent inpatient program in Corvallis. What this bill is going to address, though, is that the statute currently says that if the court finds that the youth needs to be committed, the statute only says a state mental hospital, and there is no longer a state mental hospital given the closure of the child adolescent treatment program at OSA. And so what we're hoping to do is change the language with regard to just those youth under 18 to say a secure adolescent inpatient program to cover those situations, so that now if the youth is either remanded or waived into adult court or is charged with a ballot measure 11 and would be automatically sent. If they assert the defense, they would be committed to this facility. We see it as, you know, as basically a substitute to the CATP ward that used to exist.
Madam Chair, for clarification, though, the patients that you moved or that were moved March 1st, I think was the date said, away from the state hospital, were there any of those patients that Council Larry said that who were, I think they use the term dangerous offender or threat to something, and were they moved anyway?
Chair Burdick, Senator Byer, yes, they were moved, but the board held a hearing in each of those two individuals' case and determined that given the security that was provided at this new facility, it is a very secure facility, has a 12-foot fence surrounding the unit where our clients are going to be placed, and they are held within that secure perimeter. And so the board found that they would not, under those circumstances, pose a could be adequately controlled and treated as the language of the statute in that type of facility. And so based on that, the board agreed to conditionally release them solely to this facility.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, the issue of the bill is one thing. The issue of, and you guys, everyone in the committee has heard me say this many times in this session, other sessions, when agencies come to us and tell us this is what we're doing, it's not legal. Now you'd like us to make it, we'd like you to make it legal so we can continue to do it. And that sounds like what's happened here again. And
Senator Brzezinski wants to push back on that.
I mean, my perspective from what I'm hearing is they used the proper procedure that's in statute that allowed them to review the cases. They reviewed the cases. They made fact decisions. The fact decisions said they could release them to this particular unit because it met the criteria to make sure everyone's safe and they're going to get treated. That's the first thing. Now that we have no longer this unit at the state hospital, if we have a case in the future that they need to be referred to, there's no place to refer them. Until we change this statute, they're in limbo, and everyone's going to be at risk. So what we're trying to do is make sure prospectively in the future we have a place to send these kids when they need to. But everything I've heard, and I have not heard anything that said that they broke the law, violated the statute, they went through the protocol. If they had made the change and just moved them over there without the hearing and making these factual findings and articulating it on the record, yes, they would have broken the law. But that's not what I've heard this witness say and the person before him.
Brzezinski, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. We are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1059. And I'm going to, because of the urgency of this issue, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1059. And I would ask Senator Walker to be Vice Chair Pro Tem for the purpose of making motions. We have a dash one and a dash two amendment.
Sure. Madam Chair, I would move the dash one amendment. We need both amendments, if I'm correct. Okay. I'll first move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1059.
Senator Walker has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1059. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Great. Then, Madam Chair, I will move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 1059.
Senator Walker has moved the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 1059. Is there any discussion? Senator Brzezinski.
Madam Chair, I'll be supporting the dash 2 really for the reason that Senator Byer has the concern. This is an emergency clause that will allow, upon passage, that will have a place that's going to be, quote unquote, a safe haven to deal with these youth that need to have this type of supervision and care.
Thank you. So noted. Any objection to the dash 2? So ordered. Senator Walker.
Yes. Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 1059 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a Dukas recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 1059 to the Senate floor with a Dukas recommendation as amended. Is there any discussion? At this time, I will declare a potential conflict of interest because the Corvallis Secure Facility is a client of my company in Portland through its parent company. Is there any objection?
Madam Chair, we don't have a fiscal yet. I'm assuming there will be a fiscal of some kind.
Do we have a fiscal on this?
We do not have a fiscal yet. If the committee moves the bill as amended, I will obtain a combination amendment, and I will send that to LFO. It'll be a few days before we get it.
Okay.
Have you gotten any indication of whether there's going to be a fiscal?
Madam Chair, I have not. I've not inquired, and I have not been advised of anything. I think we have some of the parties here, though, who would have a fiscal impact, if any, and I'm seeing head shaking no from both DHS and the Psychiatric Security Review Board.
I can't imagine, because the cost of putting these kids in the hospital was so high, it's hard to imagine that it would be.
Well, when we see the fiscal, again, as I said on the other bill, that if it's in excess of our limit, I would be supporting moving the bill to the Budget Committee.
Okay, any objections? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you be kind enough to carry this?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to open a quick work session on Senate Bill 1050, or reopen the work session on Senate Bill 1050. Senator Walker, we have a Dash 3 amendment.
Okay, Madam Chair, I've moved the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 1050.
Senator Walker has moved the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 1050. Is there any discussion?
I'm opposed.
Objection so noted from Senator Beyer. Any other objections? Please note Senator Beyer's objection. Dash 3 amendment is adopted. Senator Walker.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 1050 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 1050 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I would agree with Senator Starr that there are some bad laws, and this is clearly an area there is. I don't think this bill or this amendment makes it any better. In fact, I think it probably makes it worse. When you at least under current law, they have to maintain a C average. This says they have to be, what is the word they use now, making progress toward graduation or something like that. Satisfactory academic progress, that's more subjective. This area has been a frustration of mine since 1997 in my first session here, and this does not make any better.
Okay, objection noted.
Madam Chair, I probably should declare a potential conflict of interest here. I have a child with on child support.
Okay, conflict noted. Senator Beyer has objected. Any other objections? So ordered and noted. Senator Walker.
Let's see, where are we? I think we're moving the bill now. Or
moved.
I thought I made the motion.
Oh, that was the amendment. Okay, I apologize.
Okay.
We won't pass it again. We will just pass it once, and I will carry this bill. And Senate Judiciary is adjourned.